Hey everybody, I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Amen.
Tall people, that's what I'm saying, you know, tall people. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001, and for that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And man, it's good to be back in Georgia, I'll tell you that. It's great to be here. Of course, it's great to be anywhere, really. I mean, after being shelled away and just, I had to make sure I had my pants on before I came down here tonight to, so used to being in that box, you know, so I want to thank Mike and the committee for asking us here. Gosh, it's been, I guess, 17 years ago when they asked us to come or whatever, but we finally were able to break out and have this thing. So it's the greatest thing is just all of us being back together again. I think that's the real key. When we talk about celebrate the miracle, the really miracle happens. I mean, as great as Zoom was for us and as grateful as I was that we had that, there's no substitute for being knee to knee with each other, to being, putting a hand on the shoulder of the new person and getting up a quarter, a cup of coffee so they don't shake it all out and, sit down and visit with them. There's just no substitute for that. And being back together to be reassembled here, to do that for this, point two, version of this conference is just great. So, you know, I'm a selfish alcoholic. I'm one of these guys that like to go in someplace. I need it to all be orderly. I need the registration desk to go. I need the snack room rocking and rolling. I need the taper where he's supposed to be. I need, you know, all that stuff just to go just right. Cause I'm selfish. I want to show up, take advantage of all that, you know. But here's what I can tell you about all that. You know, I know this for a fact for the last several years, but particularly this year when they knew this was going to happen, people have been getting together. Been getting together, giving up their time, giving up days on the week, giving up weekends, putting stuff together so that we could come here this weekend and have a place where we could join in the fellowship of the Spirit and have some fellowship and some good AA time together. And when I got here today, that's what I experienced, all that what I described, that everything was running smooth, everything was where it was supposed to be. So my hat's off to the committee for all the hard work you've put in over the last year to make this happen and to allow all of us to come here and just take advantage of all that. I know it's a lot of work and it's a lot of time and a lot of service commitments out, so I thank you for that and for all your service to make sure the people here this weekend have a good time. Particularly want to thank Mark and Carol who picked us up today, and I've been left at airports before, so it's always good when the ride shows up. That's a bonus, really. So it's a good deal. I prefer to be picked up by the Al-Anons. I'll tell you why. About 5-6 years ago, Lori, you know, cause when the AAs pick you up, generally, not this time, but generally when the AAs pick you up, they gotta blow in that machine to make the car go. You get a warm bottle of water, maybe, you know. Lori and I were in Massachusetts at the Massachusetts State Al-Anon Conference several years ago. She was their speaker there and I carried her bags and went along with her, but the host, the lady who hosted her called and said, tell me, you know, what you guys like. And so she picked us up from the Boston airport and got in the car. And she turns to me and said, now, Cliff, in the back, there's two ice chests. One of those has ham sandwiches, turkey sandwiches, and continued to name the list of all they had. She said, in the other cooler, and she began to name all the drinks she had. And she said, there's a little sack down there that's a cooler bag. It has cheesecake, carrot cake, chocolate cake, and I just made a firm resolution right there. From now on, the Al-Anon's picking us up whenever I get to them. I'm getting to them. You got to check it out, at least I'm telling you. So, but Mark and Carol have been great today and picking us up and hauling us around, getting us here, taking us to lunch. It's just, it's wonderful to find the fellowship you crave here, you know. I knew it was going to be a good time this weekend. When we left this morning, although it was early, my neighbor was out in his front yard, and he waved goodbye to us using all five fingers. So I knew we were up for a good weekend when we got here. It was at least off to a good start. We did get on the airplane out of Oklahoma City. When they hit cruising altitude, one of the flight attendants came out and said, there's somebody on this flight that has a fatal allergy to peanuts, and we will not be serving any nuts on this flight. And it was kind of a touch and go there. There were some kids that groaned, but I watched some guys up in first class almost getting a fist fight. I mean, it was serious. And my beautiful wife, who's also kind, she just grabbed me around my arm and pulled me real close to her and said, Cliff, whatever you do, please don't tell them about your fatal allergy on this flight, whatever you do. I thought that was a good idea based on the peanut reaction that we not do that. So. You got a good set of speakers this weekend. Not starting tonight, but starting in the morning, you got a good set of speakers this weekend. I know Gigi's going to do a great job. Lisa, Lori and I have been with Lisa in Florida before. My sweet wife is going to take you home on Mother's Day and get you out of here. Going to hear some great messages this weekend of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. So I know you're in for a real treat. So we'll get the clown show over first so you get you some real recovery before this thing's all over with. You know, I know that my job tonight's to talk and your job's to listen. I need to be done with my job before you're done with yours. So let's just get through it here. So all my life, from as long back as I can remember, just not because I have great introspection as from a 5 or 4 year old, but through the process of inventories, looking back at my life, you know, I can tell you this, from as far back as I can remember, I'm one of those kids that would go walk into school and feel like I'm 15 minutes behind, be early, but feel 15 minutes behind. I can walk into class in grade school and look at kids and think, man, if my mom and dad would buy me those clothes, I'd be all right. You know, the kind of kid that would look around the neighborhoods of where my friends lived and think, you know, if my mom and dad lived in this house, if they had that job. You know, by the time I get to high school, it's, you know, if I was just taller, if I was more athletic, if I could date this girl, if we lived in this neighborhood. By the time I get in the workforce, you know, if I just had a better job, if I had his wife, his girlfriend, if I could get them both at the same time, maybe, somehow or another, that idea that if somehow I can change the external circumstances of my life, somehow I'll be okay. And I don't know where that comes from. I mean, I don't know where that kind of thought process comes from. Our good friend Larsine, who's a great member of the Al-Anon family group out in California, says, you know, information floats through the universe, it lands on my head, and I begin to take action on it as if it's the truth. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember the very first time when I came here in 2001, and I heard somebody say, I'm just restless, irritable, discontent. And for the very first time, they put words on that describe how 41 years of my life had been lived up to that point. This idea that if I'm here, I'd rather be over there. When I was 12, I wanted to be 13. When I was 13, I wanted to be 16. When I was 16, I needed to be 18. When I was 18, I needed to be 21. So on and so on and so on. Always living my life on the run. If I can just get here, I'll be happy. If I move here, I'll be happy. If I get to this spot, if I accomplish this, I'll be okay. And it's this idea that, you know, in those circumstances of my life that I didn't know that I'm describing or feeling the piece of our puzzle that is the jackpot, the real joker in the deck for all of us, this idea of the spiritual malady. You know, that I'm running from something, thinking I got to get somewhere, be something, do something, be somebody else, be somewhere else, and then I'll be okay. And when I was 11 years old, under a big old weeping willow tree on a hot July day down in Oklahoma, my brother opened up a Tall Boy Country Club malt liquor. Anybody in here ever drank Country Club malt liquor? Well, for the rest of y'all, that's God working in your life. That's all I need to tell you about that. But he opened up that big Tall Boy Country Club malt liquor, and he took a big drink, and he handed it to me. And I'm going to tell you, on that day, the magic of alcohol happened for me. And I say it's the magic of alcohol because that's kind of how our textbook describes that. It talks about the illusion created by alcohol and the real alcoholic. And I need to tell you, I'm a real alcoholic as described in that book. And I remember that day I took that drink. Now, that I didn't puke and black out into my social drink, and that wasn't my experience. But what I knew on that day was I needed to do that again as soon as I could and as often as I could. Because in an instant, everything that I just described to you seemed to disappear. All that restless, irritable, discontentedness just seemed to go away. Just seemed to magically just disappear. And by the time I'm in high school, I'm a daily drinker. The legal drinking age in Oklahoma when I was growing up was 21 for guys and 18 for women. So when I was going to high school, you needed an older woman at all time with you. But a buddy, but we would pool our money together. There was a little Zippy Mart in a little town I grew up in, and the legal drinking age there at 6 a.m. was old enough to get your money on the counter. And he and I would pool our resources every day. We had a 0-hour class start, I think, like 7 or 7:30. So we'd meet 6, 6:30, pool our resources every day, and we would buy an 8-pack of Pony Miller. The champagne, the bottle beer. You know, we'd buy that Pony Miller. We'd split it right down the middle. I'd have 6 and he'd have 2. And I would, I'd get that cool buzz on. I could go to class and navigate around those people feeling somewhat like I fit. Seemed like it was okay. Became a blackout drinker in college when I was at Oklahoma State in Stillwater. Became a blackout drinker, and I thought blackouts were just what everybody experienced. I don't know that I'm experiencing something that the average temperate drinker or the heavy drinker may not experience. I don't know that, but I'm not talking to anybody about it. I'm just experiencing that. If you're not a blackout drinker, it's an interesting phenomenon. I could start with this crowd, and we could start tonight. And somewhere in the wee hours, I'd wake up with this crowd over here. That's a glum lot, for quite frankly, if you're waking up with those people. And you don't know whose turn it is to go. It's kind of a tough job. You know, it's a tough spot. But I don't know about that because I'm not talking to anybody. And I'm going to tell you, those feelings that I talked about, they intensify. And growing up, I can remember being with my family. When I read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when it got to talking about in our book on step 3, when it talks about selfishness, self-centered, that's the root of our problem. When I really look back at my life, I begin to see how I had been a role assigner my whole life. That I had expectations, you know, because of my selfishness and self-centeredness, that I would meet someone and instantly assign them a role. How that's supposed to look, how you're supposed to act, and how you're supposed to look in my life. I don't tell you what that role's supposed to be. I just assign it to you. And the trouble is, I'm continually disappointed because you don't follow the script that's so obvious to me, but obviously not to you. But when I get disappointed, what happens? I get restless, irritable, discontented once again, and I'm back to drinking. And I'm in this vicious cycle that I have no idea about, this idea of obsession, spree, remorse, repeat, and I just don't know what that's about. I mean, I don't know what alcoholism is. How could I? I went to the University of Oklahoma after undergraduate, became a lawyer, and the first year of my law school, I didn't drink for years. The absolute most terrifying year of my life, having to deal with all that stuff without a solution. You know, just living life on life's terms without any kind of solution. But I was not to be without. I did take a hostage that first year when I was in law school. That seemed to dissipate the problem a little bit, you know, and I have a photographic memory which served me well because I'm a drinker. And I go out and I drink. I'm going to tell you one thing. I'm not a sipper. I've been around sippers. I'm not a sipper. I drink like a lot of people drink water on a really hot, thirsty day. I'm just a drinker. And when I got out of law school, I got a job in downtown Oklahoma City working in one of those big high-rise office buildings in downtown Oklahoma City. My photographic memory served me well. I can read something and generally retain it. And so I test well. I can read something, hear something, retain it, and just kind of regurgitate it back. So it served me well. I did well in school. I'm a guy that never got into a lot of trouble before I got out of, went to work. I mean, I'm a kid that just, when I was home, I wasn't a problem kid. When I was under the thumb of my parents, I was a good kid. I did everything I was supposed to do. I mean, the whole world was marching right. I would look left, but I would continue to go right with them. But when I got to college, the chains came off because I'm no longer under the thumb. And now the whole world's turning right. I'm saying I'm just going to go look left and see what's over there. I'll make it back to the right people. I'll get back right, but I just need to go left and see what's over there. And when I got out in the workforce in Oklahoma City, once I became a lawyer, I went to work for this big firm in downtown Oklahoma City. And, you know, I have these thoughts that if I can get to this, if I have this, I'll be okay. If I accomplish this much, I'll be okay. And I'm going to tell you, every time I set a goal or I say, here's a site I want to be, when I get there, I just have this something in my brain that says, is this it? Is this it? Is this it? And that restless, irritable discontentedness continues to catch up with me. And I remember it was a Christmas party, which always is a great time to drink. I made a firm resolution at the Christmas party that I wasn't going to drink at the Christmas party. I learned something about myself that year. I was in my office minding my own business, and one of the legal assistants came down and said, "Cliff, I'm going to go get a glass of wine. Would you like one?" Here's what I discovered about myself. The only time I ever have answered no to that question was if I misunderstood the question. And it was pretty clear that day, and I got it. And, I'm a drinker. I don't sip. I drink. And I blacked out. And it was just one of those nights where you come back to work after the holidays and everybody gets up and closes their doors. It's just not good. And but I don't know what alcoholism is. I've got some old ideas about that. And I don't understand that. I mean, I don't know what alcoholism is, so how could I know that I'm afflicted with it? So it looks something like this. When I went to work for a big law firm in downtown Oklahoma City, before that I just was a drinker with my friends. I mean, there were people I drank with, and I'm sure you had this kind of experience. There were some people I drank with in college, and when I'd come home from the holidays, come back home from college, we all kind of got back together. There were some friends of mine that drank and looked a lot like me. We would start drinking on Christmas afternoon because you got to haul in the booty first. And we would start drinking Christmas afternoon and we wouldn't come back till like New Year's Day. We just go burn it down for like a week, man. I mean, and they looked a lot like me. And then the strangest thing happened to those people. They would meet him. They would meet her. They got these great jobs out of college. And they just stopped drinking. They just stopped drinking. And the crazy part about that was when they stopped drinking, their life got better. They started getting promotions at work. They started having kids, buying houses, buying bigger houses. They got those things called 401Ks, stuff like that. You know, they're staying at jobs for a while. And their life got better. And so when I'm going to the workforce, I mean, early on, it would be something like this. They would come down and say, "Hey, Cliff, we're going to go after work today. We're going to go get cocktails." Now, that sounds sophisticated. I mean, I'm a country kid. You know, when I used to have hair, when Lisa met me, I had hair. And you know, I still got the hayseed in that and the bus ticket in my pocket. I mean, I'm country. And they would say, "Cliff, we're going to go have cocktails after work. Do you want to go?" Well, I've got questions about that. I mean, it's just not a yes-no kind of deal. I got questions about it. And the questions always are, "Well, what time are we going?" And they would generally say something about 5:30. The next question, "Well, where are we going to go? Because I need to know where we're going." And they would tell me the spot, and then it would be, "I'll get the table." Because here's what I can tell you about my drinking even then. It was the way I drank continuously till I got to you people. I mean, if Mark called me up and said, "Hey, we're going drinking tonight at 9 o'clock, I'm in. But I'm going to tell you this, that I don't wait till 9 o'clock to drink. I mean, I start drinking to get ready to go drink. So I'll meet you there and get the table, because if it's at 5:30, I'm going to be there at 4:30 to get ready to drink with these people. And I don't know that's alcoholism. Got no idea about that. I just think I'm being courteous and going to get the table, Bill. I'm going to go down there. And I would go there and I would capture the table, and I'd be 7-8 drinks into the deal by the time the hour has passed, and these people would get there. And they would order their drinks, and then the cocktail waitress would come around and they'd have their drinks. And I don't know, 10, 15 minutes later, she'd come back, and it looked something like this. She'd look at the first guy, and he's got 3/4 of his drink gone, and she would say, "Would you like another?" And he says something like this: "No, my wife's cooking dinner. And it's going to be ready in like 45 minutes, and I need to get there." So with a quarter of a drink left on the table, he pays his bill, gets up, and presumably goes home to his wife and has dinner with her. And he may not drink again today, tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, may never drink again. And then there's a second person there. Now this person has about half of her drink gone, and the waitress looks at her and says, "Would you like another?" And with a half a drink on the table, she looks at the waiter and says, "No, my daughter has a soccer game. It's going to be in about an hour. It's a ways up to there. I'm going to just go now." With a half a drink on the table, she gets up, pays her bill, goes to her daughter's soccer game, gets there early, finds her on the field, goes up and hugs her, tells her she loves her, goes sits in the stands with the other parents. This is really important. Does not get kicked out of the soccer game. You too, huh? Okay. Afterwards, they go get pizza with the kids. She may or may not have another drink tonight, next week, next month, next year. May never drink again. But then there's always this third person. I know you all have experienced this in your drinking careers. Now, this lady has about a quarter of her drink gone. And the waitress looks at her and says, would you like another? And she says the strangest thing of all of them. She looks at her and says this, no, I don't care for any more. I'm beginning to feel it. Now, when she says that, what my brain thinks is, okay, now we need to start ordering tequila. Because if you're beginning to feel it, there's a window. There's a window you got to crawl into because we're about to hit about a seventh dimension of existence. I mean, things are going to get hazy pretty quick if you're beginning to feel it. But what I know today is that what that lady's saying is that the effect produced by alcohol on her is significantly different than the effect of alcohol produced on me. See, when she begins to drink, she begins to feel impaired. She doesn't want anymore. And see, that's not the effect that alcohol has on me. When I begin to drink, I don't feel impaired. I begin to feel empowered. We're getting ready to get up and do some Jekyll and Hyde kind of stuff. I mean, we're going to go somewhere and be somebody, right? I mean, we're up for a personal adventure at any moment. Maybe an expedition. I don't know. We're going to go somewhere and do something. And there's some things about my drinking that today, looking back, and I know for a fact, there's three conditions upon which I stop. Pass out, run out, blackout. That's it. Those are the only three conditions that bring me to a halt. And I can also tell you this about my drinking is that there's always a crash site. Don't know when it's going to be, where it's going to be, or who's going to be involved in it, but there's always a crash site in my drinking. And if it was just that, if it was just this idea that when I start drinking, something different happens to me than 90% of the population. If somebody could have come to me and said, listen, brother, you just got an allergy. When you drink, this phenomenon of craving kicks in, you get thirsty. You got an allergy. Well, I mean, I know people that have allergies and stuff. Hey, my mama told me I'm allergic to penicillin, but I'll tell you this. We passed a CVS today, and I didn't think, Mark, pull in. We're going to test the theory today. I mean, the thought never crossed my mind. I just believe it, you know. But we know people that are allergic like strawberries, bee stings, for God's sakes, peanuts, the peanut people. They're a class all of their own, for God's sakes. I mean, since y'all brought the peanut people up, let's talk about it for a minute. My God, these people have, they make one emergency room visit. I mean, they eat one peanut, make one emergency room visit, they quit forever. And they're not kidding about that. They get that throat swelled up, that anaphylactic shock. Man, they spend the whole rest of their lives going to restaurants saying things like this. Has a peanut ever been on this city block? I mean, it's not enough. Has it been in the restaurant? Has it ever been on this city block? I mean, they spend the rest of their lives staying as far away from peanuts as they possibly can because it almost kills them. Let me tell you about this alcoholic. I'll give away jobs, careers, children, wives, houses, cars, respectability, honesty, integrity. I never connect the dots. It's the booze. I never connect the dots that when I drink, something different happens to me. It's just that. If it was just that. But it's that other piece. It's the other piece of the puzzle for us, you know. This idea, this malady, this thing circling around the drain that drives me, that restless, irritable discontent, this idea that I'm different, I feel different, I look different, I don't fit in. What are they thinking about me? It's all that self-centeredness driving that obsession. And that's the piece of the puzzle that makes for really great talks in the morning on Sunday morning. It's the other piece of the puzzle that make people who never drink a drop of alcohol neurotic, insecure, direly, never drink a drop of alcohol, but suffer from the family disease of alcoholism. That looks something like this. So I come home and to my wife. It doesn't really matter which one. Lori is my fourth and final wife, as she likes to say, but could be any of the other previous three, but we'll just use her since she's here. I come in Thursday, and she says, cooking dinner, it's going to be ready in an hour. Need a loaf of bread. I need you to go to the store and get that. I say, yes, ma'am. I'm off to the store. And I run off to the store, and I run to the store, and I get to the store, and I come out running my friend Don. Don looks at me and he says, what are you doing? I said, well, Lori's cooking dinner. She asked for bread. I got it. And, it's going to be ready now in about 50 minutes. So I got to get home. And he said, 50 minutes? 50 minutes? Well, hey, man, we could go over here to the old log in and have a couple of beers. You'll be home in 50 minutes. Now, when I get that kind of information, I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind. You all are familiar with the keen alcoholic mind, aren't you? I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous, the only place you hear about that. Let me assure you something. They are not talking about that over the Al-Anon rooms. They're not discussing the keen alcoholic mind over there, I promise you. But I filter that through the keen alcoholic mind. I think 2 beers, 50 minutes, I can do that. So me and old Don, we run over to the log in on a Thursday night to have a couple of beers. Now, Sunday when I get home, everybody's mad at me. I mean, she's mad, the kids are mad, the dog's mad, the cat's mad. I don't know why I've got the bread. I mean, you know what I mean? Apparently a big deal on this time requirement. I'm not really hip to that. But I don't know about what you do if you find yourself in a jackpot like that, but I like to tell the story. And I like to get everybody together, preferably in front of me, because I don't want to wind up in a camp in Montana. So I get them in front of me. And I begin to tell them the story. Because, my God, everything an alcoholic does involves a story. I promise you, somebody this weekend will go to the bathroom and come back and say, you're not going to believe this, and have a story about it, right? It's just how we roll. We got stories about everything. So I begin to tell them the story. I go to the store. I got the bread. I come out. There's 50 minutes on the clock, and I run into Don. And when I hit that spot of the story, something happens in my head. And this, the voice inside my head says this. And if you hadn't run into Don, you'd been home. This is Don's fault. And I begin to tell the story based upon the delusion that this is Don's fault. And when I get to the very end of that story, I say something like this. Now, keep in mind that when I'm telling this story, I'm looking into the eyes generally of the people who I love the most, allegedly. These are wives, children, parents, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, friends, employers, fellow employees, whoever. And I look at their eyes and I say this to them, and I mean it with every fiber of my being, but I'll promise you one thing, this will never happen again. Put a lie detector on me, I'll pass it. I'll absolutely pass it. And pretty chilly at my house that night. I go to bed, get up the next morning, get it ready. It's almost like a snowfall going in there. It's so cold, you know. Get in my car. I head through rush hour traffic. I know people here know about traffic, right? So start headed downtown to work. As I'm headed downtown to work, I begin to think about that, about work, about how they don't really respect me down there at work. I'm not really getting my fair dues at work. I mean, after all, I'm down there busting my hump 2-3 hours a day. I mean, I'm killing it at work. I get to work. Nobody really talks to me. You know, I'm kind of a getting my car. I head home, traffic back home again. And then something like this happens to me. This thought comes to my head. Gee, I don't know why they're mad at me. I apologized yesterday. And when I get to that spot, I've got 12, 24 on a real good stretch, 36 hours. And what's going to happen for a guy like me is I find myself back at the bar or somebody's house or 2 drinks in, not even remember how I got started. And that's the piece of the puzzle. That peculiar mental twist, those strange mental blank spots. That's the piece of the puzzle that makes me and the people who never have taken a drink of booze on a regular basis or never in their life absolutely neurotic. And it's this idea of this spiritual peace, this physical peace, and this mental peace that make me the real alcoholic. I've got old ideas about what alcoholics are. You know, when I was a kid growing up, my mom and dad had a liquor store, and when I was a youngster, I would go with them on Saturdays. The liquor stores in Oklahoma open at 10, so we would get there about 9:45. And when we would get there, there'd always be a couple of alcoholic cars in the parking lot. Now, if you're not familiar with alcoholic cars, go out here. I saw a couple earlier today out here. They're easy to identify. Whatever color they are, there's going to be two doors that don't match. So that's just the rule. I mean, they'll have four pieces of rubber on the ground, but two of them are donuts. And there's always some cardboard, duct tape, and baling wire involved in all these cars. You know? And those old drunks will be out there at 9:45 waiting on my mom and dad to get there. And I just go back to back, watch TV. I mean, I'm just watching the Flintstones living my best life back there, you know. And my dad would catch my eye just before 10 o'clock out of my peripheral vision. And I would look and I would see those drunks out in the car. And he would go, I would swing back to Elroy Jetson. And I would hear it click and I would turn back just in an instant. And those drunks, as if they were beamed down from the Starship Enterprise, would be out of that car and at that front door. And they would come in, and depending on what the occasion was that weekend, depending on what they bought. Say it was going to be a romantic evening with somebody really special. It's the Mad Dog 2020, the Whitaker Whiteport, something like that. You know, just kind of a kickback bourbon weekend, Old Crow, Old Charter, Seagram 7, something like that. Or maybe it's just they're going to have some time at the house with the guys and they just go get some vodka. You know, the good stuff that has all consonants, no vowels, just that stuff, you know. 30 cents a half pint, right? Always buying in half pints or pints because you got to put them in your cowboy booth. For God's sake, nobody can see you taking booze out of a liquor store at 10 in the morning. And those old drunks would buy that, and they would start to go back. It was two steps up to my dad's entrance of my dad's liquor store. And invariably, about every 6 to 8 weeks, one of those old drunks would be a little Jake leg, and he'd catch a boot heel on that top step, and down he'd go. And my dad would call me, and I'd be out there sweeping up, thinking, my God, these people can't even wait to a decent hour to drink. Not a decent hour to drink. 1985, I've been practicing law for a couple of years. I'm in downtown Oklahoma City. I'm at Byron's, the largest liquor store in Oklahoma City. I can see my office building downtown. It's probably 20 blocks from downtown. I can see it. It's 9:45. I'm in the parking lot. I can give you 100 reasons why I'm in that parking lot that particular morning, and mornings just like that for many years, of why I'm there at 9:45 and how it's different from those people. All my doors match. The colors all match. I got four tires on the ground. There's no cardboard. There's no baling wire. There's no duct tape. And I can give you all the reasons there is, but because I have this old idea of what an alcoholic is, that can't be me. That ain't me. When I was in the throes of my drinking, I was in Norman, Oklahoma. I lived in Norman for a while after I got out of law school. And on a Sunday night, I'd been drinking, and good not to drink, good as any. And I always like to tell this story. So many ladies in the room. Give me a wait. We'll wait on you, Jim. We'll wait. Okay, we'll just wait. Hurry back. We'll be waiting. I was drinking that particular night. When we have this many ladies in the audience, I always feel compelled to kind of explain this story a little more. If just the guys, they'd get it. But I feel compelled always when there are this many women and ladies here to explain it. Ladies, at a lot of places, bathrooms for men particularly, this is a nice facility here. When you go to the bathroom here, they have the urinals with their dividers. But some places we go, football stadiums, bars in particular, there's just these big hog troughs we belly up to. This is going to be a hog trough night for you ladies tonight. And so I just go to the bathroom, minding my own business. I've been drinking most of the day. This guy comes in, and he's next to me, and he's busy. I mean, I don't know what, but out of my peripheral vision, he got a lot of stuff going on over there. I mean, he's in motion. And I'm curious, so I just see what's going on. And he pulls out what appears to be the world's smallest baby spoon. And he begins to put some stuff up his nose. I need to tell you a couple things. One of them is this. I'm a drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. And I got rules about my drinking. I mean, one of the fundamental rules is no drugs. I mean, no drugs. Now, I'll do some reefer with you, but I mean drugs. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I don't do drugs. And I'm watching this guy, and I'm fascinated. Now, ladies, what you need to know that if you're in a men's restroom, the last thing you want happen, and the guys will back me up on this, is get caught looking at the guy next to you. I mean, it's just, it's a man rule. It's on the card, man. I'm just telling you. Well, he caught me. What he did was, in that moment when he caught me, is he just took that spoon and maybe 2 seconds and just began to put it under my nose. Now, this is some things I need to tell you. First thing is this, that I don't know I'm run by 100 forms of fear. I don't know that all my life I've been scared to death of you people, what you think of me, how you perceive me. You know, the deal is I just want to fit. We talk about this idea of restless, irritable, discontented. This longing to be somewhere with somebody doing something, but we don't know what that is. I'm running, trying to find out, trying to figure out what that is. I don't know that fear dominates my life. I don't know that selfish, self-centeredness, that's the root of my problem. And because of that, it creates this masterpiece for fear. That our book says that it's so bad, in fact, welcome back. Well, it's so bad, in fact, that it ought to be classified with stealing. I don't know that. Here's what I also don't know. I also don't know this, that when I start drinking, doesn't matter what my rules are, doesn't matter what I tell you I'm going to do or not going to do, that when I start drinking, a different guy begins to make decisions for me in my life. And when that guy dipped that in there, my rules go out because the instant thought came to me was, what will he think of me if I don't do this? I'm so governed by fear. I'm so worried about what you think of me, how you perceive me, how I look to you, that I just took a big sniff, and he put one under the nose. I took another big sniff. Now, here's what you need to know about that night. Every time that guy went to the bathroom, I followed him in there. That's what you need to know about that. But I did find a cure for the blackouts, I'll tell you that. And so, you know, I had, they sent me to treatment in the 80s. They seemed to think I have a drinking problem. I went, not because I believed I had a drinking problem. I went because they thought I had one. I don't want you good people to think I didn't recognize I had some kind of problem. I did. It seemed to me it was a back problem. Everybody was on mine. I need to get them off. I'm going to go to treatment to get them off my back. And I came back from treatment. They said, you need to go to AA. And I started going to AA. And I sat in your chairs, and I drank your coffee, and I chased your girls around, caught one, took her hostage. We produced a hostage act, and I didn't change anything about my life. Nothing. Didn't change anybody. I just didn't drink. Still lying, still cheating, still stealing. And I'm in Dallas. It's been a couple days since I've had a drink, and I'm in Dallas. And on the outside of my life, if you looked on the outside of my life, by the yardstick the world measures it by, you would think, this guy's got it going on. By this time, I'm the first name partner. I'm, 33, 34. I'm a first name partner in a major or my medium-sized law firm, downtown Oklahoma City. I have 30 people that report directly to me. I represent several Fortune 500 companies. I was telling Mark about the time I was out here in Atlanta. One of my crash sites was in Atlanta. And we came out here to do a bunch of depositions. I was a trial lawyer. We came out here to do a bunch of depositions. We stayed downtown, and the basketball team was playing, so we get limos because you can't do anything unless you do it up big, right? You just do whatever. And so one of my crash sites were here. But they sent me to treatment, and I just didn't change anything. I'm in Dallas doing some kind of big deal, and you folks knew it was a big deal because I was involved in it at the time. So we conclude that big deal, and we're having steak dinner that night, and the cocktail waitress came around and said, would you gentlemen like a glass of wine with your dinner? And I've already told you my experience with that. The only time I say no to that is I misunderstand the question. I just started drinking. And I remember the next day I got my car thinking, see, I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. Had a glass and a half. I mean, I had bad luck and trouble with the 80s, but this is the 90s. We're just going to say no and just roll, you know. In the summer of 1993, I came back to Oklahoma City to get my social life cranked up again. I have a house on the golf course. I don't play golf, but it looks good, so I have that. And one day I went out to buy a car. I bought two because if you buy one, you need two. What for? I don't know. But that was in August of 1993. In December, 2 days before Christmas, 4 months after I began drinking again, I came home, went to my kitchen. My little girl was 3 years old. Came to my kitchen, tore off 7 black garbage bags, went back to my room, began to pack everything that was important to me in my life. And 2 days before Christmas, my little girl hanging on my leg, 3 years old, saying to me, "Daddy, please don't go. Please don't go. I don't know what alcoholism looks like on you. I don't know what alcohol does for you. But I can tell you what it does for this alcohol. It tells me to live the life that it demands me to live. And I'll step over anybody or anything to live that life." And you'll hear people come behind this podium, and I get what they're saying, but they'll tell you about what they've lost behind their drinking. "I've lost this, I've lost that." I want to be really clear tonight with you people. Because Mike said I had to tell the truth, so that's key. I've never lost anything. I gave it away. I gave it all away to live the kind of life my mind demands me to live. And I got my social life cranked up again and got going. And alcoholism, our book talks about alcohol career, our drinking career. A buddy of mine says, we ought to have trading cards, just have our stats on it. You know, we trade them so we know what our stats are. Careers. And the hostage in the hostagette, they got set free. And again, objectively, it looked good. And I never had consequences like people. My drinking got so bad, I just quit showing up for court. And people would cover for me. It's not a good day. Some of you might have had a minor traffic ticket where you need a lawyer. That's probably usually the case I get around here. And your lawyer don't show up, it's not a good day. And people would cover for me. And they would throw pillows under me. And they wouldn't let me have consequences. They wouldn't let me. They just didn't want to because of the shame that might fall on them. And in the last three, you know, somewhere in there I met Lori and didn't know she was untreated Al-Anon. I just knew the horns in my head fit the holes in hers. And we began to do the alcoholic dance, you know. And Lori had this great job in Oklahoma City. She was the first woman salesperson back in the mid-90s, selling sports radio when sports radio began to take off in the mid-90s. First woman sales. She had this great job. She was making great money and I just quit working. I like to tell people that's when I became a functioning alcoholic. I had a wife at work, you know. I just tell them I'm a real go-getter. I take her to work and go-get her. That's what I do, you know. And the last 3 years of my drinking, I just never drew a sober breath. And that law firm I'll tell you about, you know, I would tell you that I'm a selfish alcoholic. Say, you know, my drinking never hurt anybody. But in 1997, that law firm, when I quit showing up for work, that law firm got evicted because when the rainmaker stops making it rain, the crops grow. And on that day, 30 people lost their jobs, just like that, 30 families. But I would look you in the eye and tell you my drinking never hurt anybody. Finally, in the summer of 2001, Lori had about all me she could stand, and she put me out of the house, and I came up with my very first newcomer plan. If you're new or you're nearly new in Alcoholics Anonymous, let me just say this. If you haven't heard anything I've said, please hear this. You're wanted, welcomed, and needed here. You're absolutely wanted, welcomed, and needed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're also new, listen up. Here's a great plan for you. I had to come up with a newcomer plan. And the newcomer plan was this. I remember going to AA, and she thought I had a problem with my drinking. So what I would do is I would go to AA, tell her I was going to AA, do that 30, 60 days, kind of see how the temperature is, and then I would slowly go back just living my life. It's a foolproof plan. If you're new, buy on this plan. But now if you're alcoholic and new, it's not worth a tinker's darn, I found out. But if you're not, it's good. So I just started going to AA. Found out something about myself when I went to AA is that I'm not like my friends. You remember the ones I told you about, the ones I grew up with, the ones that used to go out drinking with me, and they met him, her, got the great jobs, and they quit, and their life got better. I quit drinking. My life didn't get better. It got worse, infinitely worse. Some things I don't know about me. I don't know that I'm in the grips of a progressive illness. I don't know that over any considerable period of time, I get worse, not better. I don't know that it's not a drinking problem that I have. It's a drinking solution that I have. That drinking has been the only thing in my life that's held me together long enough to try to function. It's the only thing that's held me here to keep me from flying off the face of the earth. It's been my solution. And if you're restless, irritable, discontent, why isn't it okay to want ease and comfort? Because that's what booze did for me. But I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous for 45 days with my newcomer plan, thinking, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? Because that's the only thoughts I have. And I sat there for 45 days, and on the 45th day, I got up out of an AA meeting, and I went directly to a bar and started drinking on a Thursday, and I ran away from home one more time. And I come home on a Sunday, and she's not excited at all to see me. Everything, ever watch about this, the people in your life that that you come home to, or these Al-Anon types, right? God bless them. I'm grateful for them. If it hadn't been for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be here. But they're a strange lot. Because if you got one of them and you go at large, because I go at large when I start drinking, you know, they call everybody that you know. If you got friends left, they'll call them, but they start calling these people hospitals, jails, sanitariums. I mean, just go down the list. Police departments looking for you, worried, sick. And then the minute you show up, they go get a shotgun. Think about that. I mean, that's a baffled lot. I'm going to tell you right now, it's a baffled lot. Thank God for Al-Anon. So I just go at large again, run away from home, come home on that Sunday night. Nobody's happy to see me. She throws me out of the house again. I went to a buddy of mine's house and detoxed on his house for, on his couch for a couple of days. And on August the 15th of 2001, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous and I sat down. I didn't know it was going to be the day I sat down here. Really, if we probably took a poll, most of us would probably been just as good to take a dart and throw it at a calendar. I had no idea that on August the 15th of 2001 was going to be the day that God struck me sober. I had no idea about that. I didn't come back that day to get sober. And if you're new, you're nearly new here, you don't have to want to be sober to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my experience here. You know why? Because of this right here. Celebrate the miracle. Because what happens to me is booze is the magic in my life. It seems to give me the sense of ease and comfort. But what my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous is since August 15, 2001 to this very moment is that Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to find the God of my understanding who brought the miracle of recovery in my life. And I didn't want that when I got here. That was not what I came to AA for. On August the 15th, 2001, I came here with still the same problem. I'm homeless and I need to get back in the house. I revised my newcomer plan, 60 to 90 days. I got to figure out how to get over the 45-day hump, but I'm going to figure it out. And I sat in Alcoholics Anonymous on that day thinking, how do I drink and how do I stay sober? Because I don't know that I'm in that, I'm caught in that obsession trap, that the restless, irritable discontentedness, that the four horsemen of life continue to show up for me, and every day it gets worse and worse and worse. And all I can think about in the grips of the obsession is how do I drink and how do I stay sober? And on August 15, 2001, I'm sitting at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know if you have a chatterhead. I got a head just likes to talk to me all the time. It's talking to me in that meeting. How do we drink? How do we stay sober? We got to get together on this, you know. How do we do all this? And suddenly my head went stone cold quiet. Now, I don't know if God's ever spoken to you, but he's talked to me one time that I know of. Out loud. In my head. Now, if you're seeing a therapist, I don't, and you've had this experience, I don't recommend you telling them that because they'll put you in a straitjacket. They'll call the people to come get you. Just tell it here. But this thought came to me. If you don't do something different today, you're going to die. When I was 5 years old, I grew up in West Texas the first 5 years of my life. And we were moving. My family moved back to Oklahoma where they were from. And I thought it was at five. I thought it would be a good idea to go with them. And we moved back to Oklahoma. We were packing and they were loading stuff in the U-Hauls to have them move it here. My mom and dad had a stand-up deep freeze. Of course, it was unplugged and opened. And somehow or another, I crawled in there and the door shut on me. And when my mom found me in a panic, boy, there was just a little bit of air left in there. And I was sweating profusely, and she dragged me out of there. Of course, she was frantic about that. When I was in high school, I was a bull rider. I say that like it was something special. I've tried to ride bulls, and I broke my neck and walked around a week. I didn't know it was broken. I walked around a week before I went to the hospital and finally hurt so bad. I thought I just strained all my muscles. They began to stick all these pins in me and do these x-rays, and they came and told my mom, he's got a a break that only one out of 100 walks away from. 98 die. One of them ends up like Christopher Reeves. And one idiot walks away from that. I was drinking and a few years later and my dad called me, so I need you to come help me. And I've been out for about 3 days drinking. He called me and about 11 in the morning, I'm just trying to sleep it off. And I go to help him and I'm on the highway coming out of Texas and Oklahoma. There's an overpass and I just pass out. I just go to sleep as I'm coming over the overpass. There's a semi-trailer truck parked on the side of the road. The middle of my pickup hits the left corner of his in just a dead sleep and spins me around the middle road. The engine ends up in the passenger seat. There's just enough room for me to be sitting there with a busted lip and a busted head. When I was in college at a fraternity house at Oklahoma State University, homecoming's a big deal there. It's a big deal. And my fraternity house, active participant in that, and I'd been drinking on Friday night, but they wanted the pledges to come down, cut chicken wire and pump, and so they came, got me up, and I was cutting chicken wire. It's like 7:30 in the morning. I'm walking while intoxicated, and they want me to go help move the scaffolding. It's a big scaffolding because we're putting stuff up, and so seven guys got on that, and I began to walk to them, and I'm as close from here to Lisa, and those guys tip the line. It hits a high power line. Four of those guys that were in tennis shoes got blown away, but three guys who had cowboy boots stuck to that and electricity, and they stayed there until they could get the power on. On August 15, 2001, when I'm sitting in the AA meeting, the voice of God said to me, if you don't do something different today, you're going to die. And I heard that. You good people circled up, said your prayer, and I bolted for the door because that's all I know how to do. Now, what I didn't tell you was for those 45 days I'd been coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, occupying chairs, there'd been an old man there. And the room, of course, was much smaller than this, but it had two exit doors that you came in and out of. And old Don, he would catch me every day. And he would look at me and he'd say, Bub, how are you doing? And I would look at him in all earnestness and give him the alcoholic answer. Fine, I'm fine. And he would just look at me and say, well, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know. And I'd say, well, I will. And I'm gone. Oh, after about a week, I figured it out that Don was catching me. I'm a slow guy if I've been drinking, you know. After about a week, I'm hip to this now. He's catching me. And so I made a fake, like I was going to this door, but I went to that one thinking I'll get him, you know. This is where I discovered that drunks, drunk or sober, can beam down just like the Starship Enterprise, you know. There he was at the other door, you know, caught me. And on August 15, 2001, I broke for the door. Old Don caught me one more day. Let me tell you about Don. You all know Don. You know Don. You don't know this Don, but you know him. Let me tell you about Don. Don had this fundamental belief that if you weren't at the meeting 30 minutes early, you're late. You're late. Now, I don't know about what it was like for you when you were new, but when I was new, there wasn't anything worse than being somewhere you don't want to be than being there 30 minutes early. I mean, for God's sake. And old Don, he would get there and he would come in and set up the tables, get the books out, straighten the chairs, start making the coffee, get it ready for people. And if he wasn't doing that, he was always out in the ante room, and he had, for lack of better description at the time, what appeared to be acolytes. And they would be out at these tables out front, and those people only knew three things. Read, write, pray. That's all they knew. You could come floating through there, they'd be read, write, pray, read, write, pray. Don had them on their knees, writing, doing something all the time. And then they would float into the meeting room. And I don't know how y'all do it here in Georgia. I'm sure it's wrong. But the way they do it in Oklahoma is they make an announcement at the front of the meeting after it gets started and say, is there any AA-related announcements? And my God, it seemed to me that every time I was in a meeting with Don, the hand would go up and he would begin to tell everything going on in Alcoholics Anonymous worldwide. I mean, sometimes 45, 60 seconds he would dominate the meeting, you know. Just on and on about all this stuff. And if there's a newcomer there, my God, he and the acolytes were like chicken on June bugs. I mean, just going attack mode. I mean, they're passing out books and writing numbers down. I mean, it was just a flurry of activity. I hope you have somebody like Don. in your life. Because old Don loved me when I wouldn't allow him to. He just loved me. So August 15th, after God talked to me, I broke for the door and old Don called me one more time. And he looked at me and said, "Bub, how are you doing?" And I'm going to tell you something. On August 15, 2001, I gave him a different answer. I said, "Man, Don, I'm not doing so good." And he just looked at me and said, "I know." Genius. And he looked at me and said, "Well, listen, if there's ever anything I can do for you, let me know." And I said, "Man, I need a sponsor." And that was just a statement, but he thought it was a question. And he got excited. I mean, he started gyrating around. I thought he was going to pee his pants, quite frankly. He just started gyrating around. I said, "Man, that's a lot to ask of somebody. Let's sit down and talk about that." And what Don did for me on that day is he began to talk the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to treatment. I can't tell you how many AA meetings I've been to. But see, I was not able to hear the message. I had not been convinced of my problem. Whiskey had not done its job on me. I think the kindest thing that Don ever did for me was in those 45 days, he would offer me friendship and fellowship. And when I didn't want that, he would step aside and allow whiskey to do the job for me. He would allow me to get done. He didn't try to pull me up one drink short. He never said to me, "You need to do this, you need to do this." He offered me friendship, fellowship. I didn't want that. He'd step out of my way and allow that to happen. He allowed whiskey to do the job. And on that day, I'm homeless, I'm broke, I'm desperate, and I'm going to tell you something. We talk about it. The book talks about incomprehensible demoralization. We talk about it, the gift of desperation. Don't be confused. It's simply grace. Simply grace. And grace falls on all of us, not just us here tonight. The power of the God that I've come to understand here, then in Alcoholics Anonymous, it falls on everyone. But the trouble with people like me is I'm selfish and self-centered. It's the root of my problem. And what happens, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm in a knot. And you'll offer me what you have here. You'll talk to me about what you have. You'll tell me about the blue life preserver that you have because I'm a drowning man. I don't know I'm a drowning man. And you talk to me about the blue life preserver you have. And what I do after about 15, 20, 30 days, I get to feeling better. And I look at you and say something like this: "I only accept orange life preservers." And I reach up and I begin to close the window on grace. Grace exists, but I begin to close the window on it because selfishness, self-centered is the root of my problem. I get to feeling better. It's the worst thing that can happen to alcoholics with no program of action. I get to feeling better and I get a good idea. But I'm going to tell you, on August the 15th, 2001, grace happened and Don, he got through the window. And he carried me a beneficial message of hope. He didn't talk to me from any kind of moral or spiritual high top. This was a guy with a real answer. He shared with me his experience, drinking, what he was like, what had happened to him, and what he was like today as a direct result of the 12 steps and the program of action, the God of his understanding he'd found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I cared to have that, he would share it with me. And then I'll tell you, when old Don was over with, you'd think I'm some kind of big-time poker player in Vegas, man. I just pushed all my chips to the middle of the table and I went all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you something. From that moment to this moment right here, I've been all in on Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not to say that I've been all in on Alcoholics Anonymous and it's all been unicorns and rainbows since then. Because if people come here and they lead you to believe from this podium that I got sober and it's all been an upward trajectory, that's a lie. I'm not saying that it hasn't mostly been an upward trajectory, and I'm not here to say that I don't have this really good life today. But Bill Wilson described in his story the fact that what a guy like I have to do when I come here is I have to perfect, which simply means make better, and enlarge, which simply means make bigger, the spiritual life that was offered to me with the God of my understanding when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And why do I need to do that? Bill says, for the certain trials and low spots ahead. And I've had those here. I've had those in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or you're nearly new and you're riding the cloud, buckle up. That's all I'm telling you. Because to tell you anything less than that would be dishonest. And Mike said I had to tell the truth. And at 9 years sober, what happened is I came home one day and my wife caught me and she said, "We got to talk." And she said, "You know, you're physically sober, but you're not spiritually, emotionally, or mentally sober." And I was not. Some of you might not have heard about this, but I became the sheriff of Alcoholics Anonymous in Oklahoma at that time. It's a tough job. It's a weighty job, quite frankly. And I quit sharing my experience and I began to tell people what to do. And I'm going to tell you, I'm a guy that breaks every tradition we have here. I'll talk about your groups. I'll talk about you. I'm a disunifier in AA. I'm a disunifier, you know. I'm making a name for myself in an anonymous program. And that in and of itself is a form of insanity, right? I want to be the head sick here. That's what I want to be. And she just looked at me and she said, you know, the resurrected powers of the alcoholic ego is phenomenal. And here's the crazy part of that. I think I'm doing really good. I think I'm really good. I'm helping all these people. I'm doing all this stuff. I have a lot of activities in my life, but I'm lacking on action out of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous still. And she looked at me and she said, "You're not any of those things, and we're going to have a sober home and you have to go." And at 9 years sober, I got kicked out of my house once more. I went to Don's house and I sat down with him. Maybe you've had this kind of experience yourself, but I was talking to Don. Have you ever had something come out of your mouth and think, maybe if I just change the subject, they won't hear that. I can just move on and they won't even notice it. I mean, it came out of my mouth, and the minute it came out, it's like God took a little silver hammer and just tinked me right on the head. I looked at him and said, "You know, Don, I just got to get back to basics." And it just, bam, as if we have anything else here. As if we have anything else other than trust God, clean house, and help others. Like there's some status I can ascend to that hopefully you all will one day get there. But until then, I'll just minister to you and hopefully you get there, you know, kind of reach a guru status here. Our textbooks say, you know, we roll shoulder to shoulder with people. And on that day, I remember it. So, you know, to come here and be less than honest about the tough spots I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I've gone through spots where, you know, that building I got evicted from at about 3 years sober, I went and made amends to them for the last 17, 18 years of my legal career. I've practiced law in the building I was evicted from. All those federal judges I used to not show up for, I had to go clean all that up for them. And for years, those judges, most of them have now retired, would call me on occasion and say, "Cliff, there's someone in my courtroom today I think you could help." I got there, they would give me their personal cell phone numbers. It's not fun going to a federal judge's office. First of all, when you call, you got to make an appointment. And then they're nosy. They want to know why you want to come. And there's always a U.S. Marshal sitting in the foyer. Because at any minute, you know, as I'm telling the judge what happened, they could pick up the phone and just take Cliff for the weekend. It might do him some good, you know. All those things that Don had me do, he was a book guy. He had me in that book. He had me in the action. He had me doing the things that I have to do. And, you know, as a result of that, something happened to me. As a result of the actions that Don had outlined for me, something happened to me. I had a profound alteration in my outlook of life. I got connected to a power here that allowed me to have a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism. I escaped from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that I can't drink and I can't not drink. That vicious cycle that Silkworth talked about, obsession, spree, remorse, repeat. By a direct result of those actions, I got relief from that. I got relieved and became free. And by going and sitting down with the people I harmed and looking them in my eyes and getting clean with them and asking them at the end of the conversation, you know, "What do I need to do to make it right?" And them telling me. As a result of sitting down with people and talking about the amends and the stuff I did, particularly my family members, and asking them this question: what was it like to live with me in active alcoholism? And be willing to sit and listen to the answer of what they shared with me and do what they asked me to do in order to be... to make the amends right. And all those things that have happened to me, just like all of us here have experienced, those things happen to us and we get this incredible life. Yep, there are bumps in the road. Yep, there's been some downturns. And yes, while it hasn't just been a rocket ship, it's been a gradual and progressive upward trend in my life. And yes, there's been spots along the way. And yes, I've had downturns, but the shift in those downturns, the cycle begins smaller. I didn't tell you all this, but you need to know it. I do have a sponsor, and he knows he's my sponsor. That's the blessing of all that. I do have a home group. Got a men's group on Wednesday nights I go to. We're set up breakdown meeting in the basement of a church. And on those nights, if I don't make it there for whatever reason, those guys are calling me and say, where are you? See, I have a connection. I have a bond with humanity. I no longer have defective human relationships. I'm no longer assigning roles to people, or I try to diminish the times I do assign them roles. And I've got this really, really good life today. This really, really good life today. There was a couple in Italy. They were coming to America, and they saved money for like 2 years to come here. And they had these two little kids, and they could only afford tickets, even saving for 2 years, down in the bowels of the ship and in the steerage. And they got on there. Before they went, they bought all this cheese and summer sausage and bologna and all this bread so they could eat on the voyage to America. And the little kids were trapped in the stateroom there with them, you know, in the small room, these four people. And eventually the kids said, you know, please let us, we'll just play in the hallway. Just let us play in the hallway. And so the parents finally acquiesced after about 4 or 5 days and let the kids out in the hallway. Said, but stay down here. Don't wander off. And after about 30 minutes, the dad looked outside and the kids were nowhere to be seen, and they were just, it seemed like they disappeared. Hour went by, they didn't show up. Hour and a half, about 2 hours went by. They were sick and worried, the mom and dad just didn't know what to do. Finally, there was a knock on the door and they opened it up and there were the kids. And in their arms was roast beef and pie, and they had boxes of food that they had brought down, and they looked at these kids and said, my God, where did you steal that food from? And the kids looked at him and said, no, it comes with the ticket. When you come here, you get all of this. All of this comes with the ticket. We don't have to stay in the stateroom. We can go up, and there's a banquet upstairs, and it comes with the ticket. That's the way it is in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can come here. You can settle for the cheese and the bread you bring with you. Or you can come upstairs to the banquet table. I don't know about you. I'm a selfish alcoholic. I want the whole enchilada. I want everything that Alcoholics Anonymous and the God of my understanding has for me. And I don't, to get that, what I have to do is be a dutiful and a trusted servant. To do what God has tasked me to do, and all of us to do on any given day. And that's simple. What Don reminded me of that day. I have to trust God, clean house, and help others. Thanks for having me.